quotes.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Today on Street Strong, we're honored to have a truly inspiring guest, Bryce Hancock, the heart and soul behind Mile High Recovery Center. From the streets of Congress Park, Denver, to the forefront of addiction recovery, Bryce has turned his personal battle with substance abuse into a lifeline for many. As the CEO and founder of Mile High Recovery Center, he's not just a visionary, he's a survivor who's dedicated his life to helping others find their path to recovery. Bryce's journey from a career musician and entrepreneur to a leading figure in addiction treatment is a testament to the power of transformation and resilience. Join us today as we dive into Bryce's story, the innovative approach of Mile High Recovery Center, and the unwavering mission to rebuild lives beyond addiction. Bryce, so happy to have you. Welcome to Street Strong.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. It's a real honor.
Of course, of course. It's our pleasure. So, Bryce, to kick things off, I'd love to go back to the beginning. Could you tell us about your journey and what initially led you down the path to not only confront your own struggles with addiction, but also to decide to dedicate your life to helping others through recovery?
Sure. So I guess it started when I was 18 and I moved out of the house. I went to college and I became a daily blackout drinker. So I was always prone to depression and anxiety and, you know, have my own story of childhood trauma. And so, like I said, when I hit 18, daily blackout drinker, immediately I knew things were wrong. I wasn't drinking like a normal person. I was an alcoholic, like right out of the gate. And then when I graduated and most of my friends matriculated to regular life and got careers and families, I moved to Baltimore, Maryland. And within a few years, I was addicted to heroin and crack.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I hung around Baltimore. I played music there and then owned a recording studio. So I'm an entrepreneur and it's always trying different businesses. Crashed and burned there, completely addicted to heroin, and then moved to Denver. I followed my parents to Colorado and drugged the bottom in Denver for a couple decades.
Yeah.
I played music though, so I was sort of able to always dial back my drug use and just drink. Because I had this passion, and it's hard to be addicted to crack when you're, you know, it's hard to do music and that. So dial back my drug use. And then I was playing music and booking bands and booking my own band. And then I was so good at booking my own band, I started booking other bands. And then I was, next thing I know, I'm a booking agent. So I'm doing that. And then I was booking a couple clubs. And then one of the clubs said, do you want to own this club? You want to own a bar? And I was like, yeah, sure, I do, but I don't have any money. And he said, I'll carry the loan for you, which means I walk into being the owner of a bar with no money. And I, you know,
wow.
A huge, you know, problem with substances. And so I was, you know, 7 years into that. 2013, I got sober. So a couple years before that, I'm in and out of the doctor. And he said, we're going to do a blood test on you. And they did a blood test. And he said, I remember I came back to his office and he showed me the chart and it said alcohol abuse severe. He said, you're a late stage alcoholic. Your liver is cirrhotic. Your pancreas is totally stressed. I'm surprised you haven't had a heart attack. And I give you a year to live if you can't stop drinking. And I could not stop drinking. I drank for well over a year. And finally, eventually ended up in a psych ward. So I started going to AA meetings. So I'm a product of 12 step. So I started going to AA meetings. It was free. It was easily available. Those were my people. They drank the way I drank. They did the drugs the way I did. And so I kicked around in there for a while and then had this super bad relapse where I ended up in a psych ward and got out of that and really dove into 12 step and did some IOP, intensive outpatient treatment.
Yeah.
And yeah. I did all that. And so got sober with much drama and it was really difficult. I'm not gonna lie, it was hard, but so getting sober is difficult. Staying sober, I find pretty easy. So I was about, you want to just keep going? I'll just keep going.
Well, I love this so far, and I appreciate you being so open. I'm sure the listeners are so happy to hear that too. It encourages them. So a lot of folks that I meet on Skid Row, they have a really hard time staying sober. I want to ask about that a little bit later. But when we talk about the psych ward and intensive outpatient that you pursued, for the listeners, intensive outpatient is a sort of in between, where you're not fully hospitalized 24/7, but you are getting really robust mental health care treatment, usually going every day, Monday through Friday. Can you talk about the role of mental health treatment in your sobriety and kind of stay there for a moment and how that maybe reshaped how you approach sobriety and your general goals?
So this is my experience, right? My experience was that I was on all kinds of antidepressants. And so when I was 21, I started doing antidepressants, Prozac, Paxil, all these things. And the SSRI sent me into a manic episode. And so they were like, oh, you're bipolar. Meanwhile, I'm smoking crack and doing heroin and drinking every day. So it's really hard to tell what was wrong with me. I was definitely an addict and definitely an alcoholic, but I always had this thing like, oh, I'm bipolar. And so in the psych hospital, I said all the things that I knew would get me that diagnosis because I wanted the meds. And so they diagnosed me bipolar 1 with rapid cycling and post-traumatic stress disorder from early childhood trauma. And I was, believe it or not, I was pleased to hear the diagnosis because, one, it meant, like, I'd rather be like I would have rather been mentally ill than admit I was alcoholic or had an addiction problem, right? And so I was like, right. I didn't know. I'll just keep talking about it. And so,
sure.
They put me on all this stuff, you know, they put me on Paxil, like all these mood stabilizers and all this stuff. And I felt awful. I felt worse. And so I had a decision to make for myself. Like, do I want to be a mental patient or do I want to just admit that I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol? And so I went back to, you know, right back into 12-step and dove into the actual work. Like, going to 12-step is great. Going to meetings is great. But there's actual, like, work to do. And as I did the work, I got better. And I'm not on any meds today. So that's why I say this is just my experience. And, you know, I own a treatment center now. A lot of people are on meds. And by golly, I believe they need it. And it helps, you know. For myself,
of course.
My addiction was first. I needed to admit that I had a disease as well as maybe a mental illness. And it was like my problem then was I couldn't make it through a day without drinking. When I would take a drink, I would not be able to stop. And on the rare occasion that I could stop, I couldn't stay stopped. I couldn't stop thinking about it, right? So the more I dove into like working on my alcoholism, the better my mental health got. And so I had this like idea, it's a chicken or egg thing. Am I depressed because I'm drinking or am I drinking because I'm depressed? And it turns out it's all connected, you know?
Oh yeah.
And so that was my experience as an alcoholic and an addict is that I'm not on any meds anymore. You know, I'm grateful for that.
Right. Well, that's a wonderful story actually. And it does go to show how complicated this can be, you know, whether it's addiction that comes first, whether it's mental illness that comes first. How do we figure that out? And especially how do we figure that out when we are actively addicted to some kind of substance, when we're not thinking clearly and it really hijacks our brain? And that makes it even more difficult. What would you say, Bryce, to one of our friends on Skid Row now who might be listening to this, who can't imagine what life could possibly be like with X, Y, or Z substance? Maybe it's cocaine. Maybe it's a methamphetamine. We get a lot of that on Skid Row. What would you say to that person who's like, you know, I just, maybe they don't even say it out loud, but they're thinking it as they hear this podcast, that they can't survive without that thing. What can you tell them about the other side of the prairie?
Well, like going through it myself is that I have a bird's eye view. Like if you will just commit to doing you don't even need to commit to doing the work. Go to a meeting a day. If you can go to a meeting today or tonight and then don't drink or use before tomorrow, you're going to have to detox, right? You might have to go to the local hospital to detox. Come on, I'm talking to addicts. We've all detoxed on our own. You got to do it, right? And so if you can just one day at a time, and I don't, I was going to 3 meetings a day because I didn't know what else to do. I had nowhere else to go. So I was just going to meetings and I was staying sober. And like what I know now is that if you can just do that 24 hours at a time, one day at a time, and just stay in it, your life is about to get super amazing. It just, like I said, it's hard at first, you know, and I understand it's hard to think your way out of this problem. And my advice is don't think your way out of the problem. Stop.
I love that. Yeah.
Trust people that want to help you because they want to help you. Like the 12th step is I have to give back what was freely given to me. I have to carry the message to other addicts and alcoholics. And that's how it works, you know? So it's like a mentor-based program. And I don't know what else to say. It's like, you know, the faster you admit you have a disease, you have a mental illness, ask for help. And like a lot of times it's like this, it's like, I'll ask for help. And someone like yourself will say, absolutely, I'd love to help. Here's what the help looks like. And I'll go, I don't want it to look like that.
Yeah.
I want it to look a different way. But it's like, you got to accept what people like yourself or like myself are willing to say and just accept that. That's what the help looks like, whether I like it or not. And trust the process.
That's fascinating. And I love that. That's a theme we hit home a lot here on Street Strong. We talk about faith. A lot of the majority of the friends I meet on Skid Row, my patients are huge into faith. It's something I didn't really understand at first, to be quite honest. I didn't understand how that happens, what is going on there. And it's just fascinating because it's true. When you're in the throes of addiction or mental illness, you have to believe, you have to have faith that there is going to be a different reality if I do X, Y, and Z. And you cannot see it in the moment. It's impossible. If you're depressed or anxious or addicted, you cannot always see and prove to yourself. No one's going to show you with a dry erase board that this is possible, but you do have to trust. And I really, that's powerful coming from you, who runs a recovery center, that it's just, you know, you have this process and people have to trust it. And so maybe let's pivot there and talk about that for a moment. So when they do come to a recovery center, or if they're in recovery period, what are some of those elemental steps that they should trust that you've just seen bring somebody to sobriety in just a more reliable way? What would you say about that process generally?
Yeah. So, you know, I got sober mostly in AA. I own a treatment center. So when you go to if you're fortunate enough to get into residential treatment, really all that's going to happen is you're going to get detoxed, assessed, and stabilized. And what happened to me was I didn't even realize that I was suffering from alcoholism and addiction until I stopped drinking and using drugs. That's when I really began to suffer. And that's when I realized alcohol and drugs, they're not my problem. They're my solution. And so I had to sit in that, right? And I had to suffer through it. And I had to have faith. Like I believed something was out to get me. I did. I believed that the world was out to get me. And having faith is just, you just twist that. It's like positive paranoia. You believe something's out there to help you. You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
And if you have faith,
I love that.
You've got half the battle right there. Like if you've got the faith that something's out there to help you, you have access to that power now, this second, today. Do you know what I mean?
I love that. Positive paranoia. I've never heard that before. Is that something that you feel like with time gets stronger as you just cultivate that mindset that people are trying to help and then it just becomes this new lens? Did that happen for you where it just grew and grew and today you're more of just a fundamentally different person than that the kid you were many years ago?
I just hit this point, man, where I was like, I was so broken and so down and just... I hit this point where I didn't trust my own thinking anymore. And I just like surrendered and reached out for help. And the help came in a way that I didn't want it to come in, but it was the help. And at least somebody was there to help me. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard to it's hard to be positive when you're addicted to drugs or you're on the street or any number of bad things are going on. It's hard to stay positive. So yeah, I didn't immediately have this like aha moment and like all of a sudden I'm like rocking and rolling. It was like every day. I still wake up in a bad mood, to be honest with you, but I know my steps to get out of it. And so when you're in that space and it's just going even worse every day, and I want to be up here, like I want to be, you know, a certain kind of person. I don't have access to that kind of person. But what I do have access to is to stop the downward spiral, ask for help, do one good thing, get myself into a safe place. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then build on that.
Yep. That's so key. Do one good thing, because it's so hard when you're overwhelmed to have too much in front of you. And it reminds me of what you said a few moments ago too. Just when you have a mental health provider for the first time and they have this batch of treatment and it's like, well, I'm not ready for X, Y, and Z. I mean, that's like moving a mountain. I can do one good thing. I can attend an AA meeting today. I can attend maybe two today, and I can only focus on today. So I think that's just really incredible perspective for the people listening, is to just do this one day at a time and do what's manageable in the moment, not to overwhelm that person, because then they'll just quit. I mean, I would imagine that's too hard for an addicted brain to just like take on too much at once.
It's nearly impossible. And that's why, you know, like I said, if you're forced to have to get into a treatment center and you can physically remove yourself from the substances, it's painful and it's definitely no fun. And you'd much rather continue to use the substances, even though you know they're bad for you. So if you can get away from it into like a safe place and go through the detox and just kind of, I kind of committed to being miserable, but staying sober. And the truth is, once I did that, it was a short time after that. It's say, I don't know. Well, maybe it's not short when you're there. It was like 4 or 5 months. I got really happy. I got like, things got really better. And it's not like I was like swimming in money and had like, you know, a hot girlfriend and all that, but I was working, I was going to meetings, and it was definitely a step up at the time. And it felt amazing. Yeah.
So you felt, and I don't mean this to be an obvious question or a trick question, but you felt legitimately better when you were not on crack and you were just living a normal life and getting fulfillment in other ways. And it just was not, like it was just, it, maybe it wasn't, the high wasn't as high, but it was just more meaningful and life was better.
Yeah, life is amazing. I feel like I've had two lives, and I understand that dopamine. I understand what happens when you take a hit of crack. It's wild.
Yeah.
I don't miss it because it's insane. It's crazy. You're not supposed to feel like that. The things that us addicts do are not normal. They're not normal. And normal people can't understand them. I understand them, right? And that's why I do what I do, because I love addicts and I love alcoholics. And I love success stories, right? Like, lights me up. But those dopamine rushes and that, I guess, controlling that kind of thing, it's really no way to live.
Yeah. And I think society pressures us to live that way. It's about happiness and short-term solutions and short-term happiness and be happy now and don't delay your gratification. There's a lot of pressure, especially with swiping and liking. It's set up to build that dopamine now. I imagine it's really hard for an addicted mind to navigate that.
I imagine. And it's, you know, like I was kind of obsessed, especially when I was still using, like, why am I like this? Why is this? Is it genetic? Is it this? Is it that? The truth is, it doesn't matter. None of that matters. Is society more difficult? I don't know. Is the swiping bad for me? I don't know. What I do know is that I have to do certain things every single day to manage my disease of addiction and to stay, to keep it in remission. Like, I got to stay sober. I think the hardest thing is kind of going, the only thing that works is abstinence for certain people. You know, like I can't go smoke a joint. I can't go have a beer. I'm done. It's done. I cannot safely use substances. And that's the hard part for me. It was the hard part for me to wrap my brain around initially, because, you know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. It's not what happens after that. I can't have that first sip. I can't have the first hit. Or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's extremely challenging, especially for folk who live on the street. And what I get, the kind of feedback I get on every week, every single week, is with patients of mine that are battling addiction, they have to go back into these environments and they're surrounded by cues. They walk down the street and there's 13 different drug users, different kinds of drugs. They're being offered drugs all the time, every day, twice on Sunday. It's hard to navigate those cues and triggers. And so many of them are desperate for housing, because once they get housing, they're a little bit insulated from that. But it's just ensnares them right back, and especially when they're feeling miserable. And so this is a, you know, maybe a harder question. I don't know if there even is an answer to it in the world, but I mean, what do you do when you're surrounded by those cues and it's just impossible to get out of them? I mean, you go into AA meetings and then you're back on the street. What can you do in situations like that? What is your take from your experience?
Well, my experience, you're right. There's probably not a real answer. I mean, but it's okay to say, I don't know. And all I can do is share my experience. My experience was I owned a bar and my wife had her, I was married at the time. I'm no longer married to her, but she had her own issues with drinking. I didn't have anywhere safe to go. I didn't know anybody that wasn't basically an alcoholic or an addict. So I just went to the rooms. I just went into AA. And like I said, I was going to 3-4 meetings. I just go there and hang out. And, but I put a few days together and I would just hang around. And I think, you know, maybe they felt sorry for me, but they started to talk to me and they started to share. And then I got a sponsor. And then that was like my guy. He's my guy. He's going to help me no matter what problem I'll hit him up. And once I started to just, like I said, stop the downward spiral, it starts to go up just a little bit, right? And you're right. I'm not going to be happy or joyful or ecstatic. It's not even about that. It's about not killing myself with drugs and alcohol and having a safe place to live, And I wasn't homeless. I'm fortunate. You know, I'm grateful that, I mean, I spent a lot of time couch surfing, but that's not the same thing. I never had to lay my head down on the concrete or, you know, I knew where my next meal was coming from for the most part, but it was still tough. I didn't have a place to live. I stayed in these day by the week motels with other people. Even when I got sober, I would do that until, I don't know, things got better. They just got better, but nothing got better until I stopped using.
Right. So it sounds like it was just, like you said in the beginning, it was a process and it wasn't overnight. And there was some hellish months there, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of hard work, it sounds like. What motivated you in those months just to keep going, given how hard it was and how it is a little, can be kind of long term? What kept you motivated? I know some of that you shared already, just thinking day by day. But was there something that just kind of, whether it was like a goal or a dream or something?
I think I had a, I had a kid, although that wasn't, and I hate to say it, but that wasn't really my aspiration. I think it was mostly I didn't want to die.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to die. I just was too scared to die. And I knew I was miserable using, and I had attempted sobriety, and I knew I was miserable being sober. And so I committed to being miserable being sober. And I did the work. I got, like I said, I got a sponsor. And I said, I don't think this is going to work. And he said, you don't have to think it's going to work. You just got to do it. And things slowly got better.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. It's a huge success story. And I think a lot of our listeners are going to be really motivated to hear that. For AA, just a brief little tips. What's the requirement for folks who've never been to an AA meeting before out there, may want to go? Can you show up to an AA meeting with any kind of substance use? You have to be sober for X amount of hours? What would you say to like the brand new AA wannabe?
It's best not to go loaded.
Sure. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
But the only rule to be there is a desire to stop drinking or a desire to stop using.
Okay.
I don't know any hardcore. I don't know anybody anymore that only drank.
Yeah.
Everybody does substances, right? And so some of my best friends in AA were definitely drug addicts. I was a drug addict. But for me, it was like the last thing that I was holding on to was alcohol. And so, and it was also the first thing that I really started with. So you don't, you know, pick whatever, NA, CA, AA. Try not to be loaded when you go there. If you're in AA, say I'm an alcoholic. If you're in NA, say I'm an addict. It's just, you know, out of respect.
Right.
Listen for your story and what people share. And when somebody starts to share something that you connect with, go up to that person after the meeting. You're not going to bother them. They're not going to judge you or look down on you. They have to help you. Like I said, that's the 12th step. And that's why we're there, is to see people get better. There's no other reason to continue to go. I've been going for 10 years and I only go because I want to see people get better.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I've heard nothing but good things from AA. I have had a few patients that get sober. They start applying for jobs and I mean, they'll go their whole lives. It's, you know, they could be sober 11, 12 years. They're still there religiously. I don't think that's an inappropriate word to use. I mean, it's religiously they will be there. And it's something they look forward to, actually. It's not even an obligation to many of my patients. They, you know, I don't know if you can relate to that same feeling, but they seem kind of giddy to go to those meetings.
It's a design for living. It's a spiritual program. I love it. I hear hilarious stories. It does something to me when I go into a room. I always leave in a better mood. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know what it is about why it worked for me, because it doesn't work for everybody. It definitely worked for me, but it's free. You know, I don't know. It's just awesome.
That's great.
I love it.
That's wonderful. No, thank you for sharing that. Now, I really want to pick your brain on something, because you made me think about it when you talked about just your career in music and owning a bar. And so it seems like something you were passionate about. We talked a few episodes ago about positive addictions. I had a patient on Skid Row who said, I asked him, I said, what's your secret to beating addiction? He said, get addicted to something else. So I'm really curious what you make of that statement. How does that jive with what you've seen at Mile High Recovery Center? What role do positive passions have to play? Is that necessary to beat addiction? A lot of questions at once, but just kind of picking your brain, whatever jumps out.
So, you know, people will say you're just addicted to a 12-step program. And I believe that is 100% true. But
yeah, that's awesome.
I'm not going to die in a 12-step program. It's a design for living. Right. It's going to help me with everything, with my relationships, my, you know, being a good dad, a good husband, a good whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I work out every day. I didn't work out at all when I was on substances. I work out every day. I still play music.
Yeah.
I believe positive. I mean, don't we all want positive things in our life? Don't we all want to be addicted to good things?
Yeah. Or
I believe in, you know, things to do and people to do them with.
Yeah.
You know, if like a friend from my childhood calls me and says, I'm getting married and it's across the country and will you come? The answer is 100% yes.
Yeah.
I'll absolutely go. I agree you got to get addicted to something else. For me, my whole life was drinking at the time. So I had to get addicted to something that was the opposite. For me, that was AA.
Yeah. You know, I think that's especially for the folks who are listening who are homeless, it's a great intro for them. I think that is Bryce and I spoke a little bit earlier about just the fact that it's free. It's available to everybody. There's chapters all over the country. There's, I mean, probably thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. It's all over the country. And so that might be a good segue for folks to just look at their mental health and sobriety a little bit more seriously. I think that's wonderful. What would you say to the shame associated with addiction? Folks who are just afraid to come forward, they think it looks like they're weak, they don't like being vulnerable. How do you approach those folks at Mile High, if that kind of presentation? What's your advice?
I'm very good at staying in my own lane, owning a treatment center. I rely on my therapist. I rely on, you know, people like yourself with actual degrees. I get it. I understand it. Now that I'm sober, it's like, who cares? Like, who cares what other people think? Does it matter? Right. It doesn't matter. We've got a problem now, here, today. Let's deal with what's going on now today instead of like what people might think. Or, and then, you know, the funny thing is, it's like, I don't know what people think. Like, I used to kind of like be like, well, I feel good about myself when I thought somebody liked me. But I don't know if they like me. I don't know what they think. I might think what they, you know what I mean? It's like a whole crazy thing.
Right.
I got to worry about myself.
Right.
Like, keep my finger squarely pointed at the problem. And the problem is me.
Right.
And I wish things were different, but they're not. And going to a meeting and saying I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict, it empowers me at this point.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you're right. I mean, there's so many of us live with that. It's like a theater in our mind. It's all made up, you know. It's like we have this ego or this hesitancy to to just change our lives. And like you said, your motivation is you don't want to die. Who cares what other people, who cares if the whole world is laughing as we walk into the AA hallway? It's we don't want to die, which is just, it seems like so much more of a powerful incentive to get help. Because I'd imagine that the addiction at some point just gets kind of not only old, but just more painful. I mean, in the beginning, there's pleasure, there's high, there's excitement. And from what I hear, it just, at the end, it gets kind of dark and dependent and not fun.
Yeah, it's just like at first it's fun, and then it's like a part of your life, and then it's a part of you, and then it just totally takes over your life. Like I would wake up and drink, you know, I'd have to get vodka before I could drink water. It's not normal, you know what I mean? Like when I was doing drugs, that was definitely first on my list for the day. I had to get high. And I just had to. And whatever way you can break it. I mean, it's like you don't need to have all the answers. Like just take one step in the right direction.
One step.
The universe will rearrange if you stay committed to just bettering your life. And if you fail, try again. And if you fail again, keep trying.
Absolutely. And there's help.
There's
tons
help.
Of helpful people out there.
Yeah. We want to help. Everybody, I mean, a lot of people want to help. Maybe a lot of people don't. Who cares to avoid those people?
Right. I mean, there's people who are, you know, attorneys, and I mean, not bashing attorneys, but there's people doing other things. There's plumbers, there's tech guys, but yes, there are like armies and legions of people in healthcare that dedicate their lives to just trying to connect the dots for these folks. And they need you to come forward. I mean, that's what gives them gratification and hope, and they want you to be there 100%. I appreciate you saying that.
Why you do this. That's why I do this, because we want to help. Right. And some people think I'm awesome, right? And some people think I'm totally full of shit.
Right.
It's fine. I don't care. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, like my sense of well-being is intact because of me and my faith. And that's the way it's going to be.
Right. I love that. And speaking of faith, you know, our listeners are all about faith. We did touch on that a little bit already, but walk me through, if you can, just little pearls of inspiration or wisdom about faith, and a little separate than AA, even though AA seems like there's a faith thing going on there. What role does faith play? A lot of my patients actually sleep in churches. That's what they do. I mean, and they read Bible. They do Bible study all day on the condition they stay sober and stay in the church. What do you make of faith out there and its role to keep us sober, to move us up?
So I don't believe I'm still sober because of myself. I believe I'm still sober because of my relationship with my higher power, right? And AA is really cool. I don't consider myself a Christian. I'm very spiritual, right?
Yeah.
But I was like, my first higher power was the group. It was the people in AA. And then at 2 years sober, I was really depressed. And I went through this period where it was like, I had to get in touch with, like, you know, something more spiritual. And for me, it was just like, I watched that movie, The Secret, you know, about the law of attraction. And I just had an aha moment. Like, everybody just needs a way in, whatever it is. I don't care if it's yoga, if it connects you to that energy force out there. Stay in space, like continue to try to connect whatever that space is. And for me, that's it. It's like the harder I try to figure out my own problems, the worse they get. The more I just kind of like give it up to God, the better they get.
I love how you made a distinction between God and a higher power, because not everyone is religious traditionally or you know, and so, but it's so true. It's tapping into a higher power, something that is more organized and wiser than you are in that moment. You may be big groups of people, maybe like, yoga has been around really for thousands of years, just something that's wise and ancient and beyond all of our understanding. I love how you made that distinction, because sometimes the higher power talk can turn folks off. And yet it's such an integral part of recovery is subscribing to that in your own unique way.
Yeah, but like I said, I was basically an atheist when I started in AA, when I got sober, and I listened to what everybody had to say, and they were my higher power, which is not sufficient. But man, it got me sober. And so I just continued to grow. You know, it just continued to grow. Yeah. And now it's like, I mean, I own a treatment center and I apply Absolutely. Spiritual principles to everything that I do. I didn't go to Harvard. It's all prayer and coincidence and miracles and just following the different threads of my life and having faith that something is there to help me.
Right.
Every step of the way. And I don't do anything without that belief that there's something trying to help me.
So, and you mentioned that at the very start of this, just in terms of that loan you got and being carried and moving your way through the bar scene. And so Mile High Recovery. So walk me through that. Because I think at one point it was a beautiful sidetrack, but now I want to understand, right? Okay. You go from vodka in the morning to owning a bar, live music, entrepreneurship, and now one recovery center, and I heard it turned into 9 recovery centers. So please, there's a big gap there we all want to know about.
Yeah, I got sober. I sold the bar. I got divorced. The bar sounds like, oh, no, he owned a bar. How amazing. It wasn't. I wasn't making any money at all. I was broke. Mm. Sold it, got divorced, moved out on my own with my kid, who somehow miraculously I was able to have half the time, got sober, made AA the center of my life. Things got better. 2 years sober, I'm depressed, very depressed and sober. I've never been like that before. Started going to therapy, reached out to help, got a therapist, worked through a lot of, childhood trauma, family of origin stuff. And at one point in the session, she goes, what's your purpose? What are you here? What do you do? What do you want to do? And I was like, I am a realtor. What do you mean? I worked real hard and passed the realtor exam. And she's like, nah, what do you want to do? And so it was like, what do I want? Who am I? Is this what it's all about? Being a sober man, just like pay bills and watch TV shows until I die, or can I do more?
It sounds depressing.
Well, it is depressing, right?
So yeah, it is depressing. No wonder.
I want to do something like yourself. You help people. I wanted to help people, but I didn't. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psych MP. I don't have any like fancy degrees. And so through this odd series of events, I was given direction. I went to this meeting and I stayed after the meeting and I asked the guy that ran it, what can I do? What can I do to give back? And he said that we need sober houses. And I didn't even know what it was, but I knew I was going to do it. And so I opened a sober house with just one, thinking it would just be kind of cool. And it was so cool that my depression lifted. I was totally up. It turned into a new career. And so I just kept opening houses because it was so, I don't know, awesome, right? And I just felt like so purposeful. And so, one house turned into 9. And then the city of Denver said, you can't keep opening these houses. And so I opened up a treatment center. I opened up outpatient treatment. I hired people like yourself, lots of therapists, actual therapists and people with degrees. And it was started charging insurance, which was a whole other thing, I didn't set out to do any of this, by the way. I just wanted to feel better. I wanted to get out of my own depression. And so I just kept doing things. And now I have 35 employees. We have residential treatment all the way down to outpatient treatment. We still got 6 or 7 houses. And I just took one step forward and the universe rearranged and whatever felt good, I just did. So I don't know. And that doesn't need to be like amazing and grand. It just, if it makes you feel good, do that.
Right. Yeah. It's got to come from within. And that's amazing how your depression lifted once you had that purpose. From everything you've said so far, it sounded like there was a lot of struggle at times and it was a lot of hard work and grueling. But this is the point where I think that something took off. I mean, when you say your depression lifted, which might have been fueling your alcohol use, for those listening, like we say, we never know what really comes first. And so a lot of times when you do get sober, you can notice that you had a lot of depression underneath there, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of avoidance. And so when Bryce talks about how that was uncovered, I guess the question is, what do you do with that? And Bryce decided to open a sober house. Now, for the layman out there, just for folks who are a little unfamiliar with this world, difference between sober house and recovery center.
Yeah. So a recovery center or a treatment center has actual therapists with degrees, and we charge insurance, and it's very clinical, you know.
Yeah.
A sober house, there is no clinical component. The therapeutic value of a good sober house is the vibe and the culture in the house. And so we try to foster that vibe and culture. There's rules and there's meetings and there's, you know, events and fun things to do. And, you know, we just create a whole community in the house. And like those people are also in early recovery. And so they're going through the same thing that you're going through. And it just, I don't know, it just all grows from there. They're your tribe. You know what I mean? So that's what sober living is for me, is like that tribe of people, that community, and that just connecting with others.
You know, what runs through my mind as you talk about this, Bryce, it's almost like our society has things upside down. It's like, why didn't we have that tribe before there was addiction? And it's funny how once the damage is done, oh, the solution is a tribe. The solution is support and faith and being together. And then it's like, well, why is that on the opposite side of this? Why is this all being done? If that's the solution to addiction and depression, and why don't we build society in a way that promotes that stuff in the first place? I just don't understand that. If that's the solution, why is it only used when we're like knocking on death's door with a meth addiction?
I assume because it benefits the people at the top to keep it this way. That's what I assume. They're, follow the trail of money or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, right. Right.
But I don't care about that stuff. Like I help people and I try to be a good person and I stay true to my moral compass. And, you know, right, like you said, the opposite addiction is sobriety, it's connection. And that doesn't mean I have like a million friends, but I do have some, you know, I have some good friends and I just help. And that's what the depression lifting was all about, was helping other people, being of service. It is its own reward.
That's the key. That's incredible. I'd imagine too, you don't have to open a sober house to serve other people, that you've probably seen people who, you know, I mean, you could serve hamburgers and it's just something that you're doing to just bring some kind of joy to someone. It doesn't have to be this giant thing.
It's whatever lights you up, man. It's just like, whatever lights you up inside. I like I said, do that. And it's like making hamburgers or open the door for somebody or I don't know, whatever you can do. Like in AA, it's like I said, it's a mentor based program. So when you get through all the steps and you go, oh my gosh, I'm sober and I have a job, and the police are chasing me anymore or whatever it is.
Right.
And at home, it's like, what do I do now? It tells you, go sponsor somebody else. And then that's when the real magic starts. It's because like having a sponsor doesn't do nearly as much as sponsoring other people.
Interesting. In terms of how you feel?
Even statistically, helping other people, sponsoring other people has real long-term statistics of abstinence.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Oh, that is fascinating. I didn't think you were going to... That's just an interesting angle I hadn't heard of before.
Well, yeah. I mean, like that first year was all about me getting sober and somebody helping me. And then it's about me helping other people. And that's where the long-term statistics come from. That's why you see these people was 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years clean and sober, going to a 12-step program and still going and still talking about what it was like, what happened and what it's like now, so that new people can come in and have access to that.
Yeah, wow. That would imagine, too, it gives you a sense of responsibility and purpose again, and it almost holds yourself accountable. It's like, well, I'm sponsoring somebody. I imagine I can't be drunk on Tuesday morning.
Well, I joke around a lot, like, oh, I'd lose my job. I can't do that, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. It's like a whole sense of purpose. And it is my job. It is my responsibility. I mean, it was freely given to me, and I have to give it away to keep it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, Bryce, so this has been incredible. I really appreciate you just going, you know, from the beginning to the end of your journey, and I think it's super relatable. I see folks on Skid Row every week, and you're singing their song. Yeah. They need to hear this. They need to know it's possible. They need to know that a very colorful engaging life is completely possible. And you really spelled out the steps and the mindset and just the pearls of wisdom that they need to just keep in mind as they go about this process. It's so much more powerful than, I think, hearing something that's too clinical, right? You know what I mean?
I never connected with any of that stuff, really. I did end up going to IOP, by the way, for 2 years because I was so afraid that I was going to relapse.
Oh, wow.
I was just
a long time.
It is a really long time. I don't even know if they suggest people do that. Eventually, they were like, dude, don't you want more out of life? And I was like, yeah, but I'm having a good time. It's helping me stay sober, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. The clinical stuff never connected with me. Going into a meeting and hearing people who used like I did, and then I'd see them day after day after day, and gosh, they appeared happy. And and it was like, that's what worked. You know what I mean? Like hearing it from somebody like me, not any of that stuff. But you know, it's also it's tough when you have actual mental health problems and you need medication. It's tough to get the correct medication. And once you do, man, then things can really start to click though.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what I see. But you're 100% right that, you know, I mean, treatment's not everything. You can't just hand somebody a pill and they're miraculously sober for the rest of their lives or their depression or trauma's eliminated. There's a lot of work. I think medications can be great to stabilize folks in a way that, you know, like for instance, I have folks on my patients will, you know, they'll do methamphetamines. And it's like, well, why do you do methamphetamines? You know, I don't ask it that way, but why do you do that? What's wrong with you? Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I'm curious because it's the answer is not because I'm morally corrupt and I make poor decisions because I love making poor decisions. That's not the answer. And it's usually something pretty mundane. It's like, well, I can't focus and it really helps me focus. Or, you know, life's kind of shitty right now and it gives me a lot of energy in the morning and I'm pretty depressed. And what I try to tell them is there are medications that do that and that don't have fentanyl in them. You know, and that you can, but again, getting those medications, that's a different story. That's harder to do for those folks.
Yeah, and they also don't feel as good as, I mean, like, you know, a good hit of meth will spike your dopamine. Like, wow, right? It just floods your system with it. And so you have to kind of like, I don't know, want to quit? You sort of have to want to quit, you know? But, you know, you look at your life, like, are you happy? Are you miserable?
Right.
If you're miserable, you got to like cut that out somehow. It's difficult.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, your liver enzymes were exploding and the doctor was getting really nervous. Do people need to hit rock bottom in your experience before that change is made? Have you seen people in your recovery center that don't quite hit rock bottom? I mean, you know what I mean? Is that more of a fairy tale or can that happen?
It has to be a fairy tale because we have fentanyl. You don't want to be an addict. You can die from fentanyl. So we can't continue to say they got to hit rock bottom, you know?
Right.
You have to come in with some sort of intervention, right? And so smash the stigma, have some conversations.
Yeah.
Provide support, people like yourself. Again, I don't have the answer. It's okay to say I don't know. What isn't okay is doing nothing. That I definitely know doesn't work. And so most of the people in my treatment center, they don't want to be there. They really don't. But some of them do get well. Don't get me wrong. Some of them, they go, you know what? This is much better than what I was doing. I just needed to be taught and to see it and sometimes to be medicated properly or to be given different tools. Because the further down you go, the harder it is, right? I mean, if you get in the system, you're in the criminal justice system, or you just got out of prison, you have no family, it's just so much harder. So, you know, I don't know.
No, I mean, 100%. It kind of, there's a book out, I think last year it was released, Poverty by America. Very interesting, but they talk about it as a knot. And I love that analogy because it is a knot. It's a knot that it's very hard to untie. And it's every like new thing. You get out of prison. Now you can't get a job. You know, you haven't seen your family in 10 years or you don't have social support. Now you don't have good access to information. Now you don't know where the AA meeting is and this and that. It's just, It's just very overwhelming. But it, that's, again, circling back, you say one thing at a time, and that's the key.
Yeah, and you know, and it's like, oh, my self-esteem. So, of course, your self-esteem is low. You're not supposed to have positive self-esteem if you're sleeping on the street. It's tough, you know, that's a tough situation.
Tough, yeah.
But it's like I said, right. We got a problem now, here, today. Let's do something, yeah. One step in the right direction, maybe, and then everything hopefully will, I don't know, keep getting better. And if they don't, keep trying. If you go to the
awesome,
yeah, just make adjustments. Just keep trying.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep pressing on. I think Churchill said when you're in hell, just keep walking.
When you're going to hell, keep going.
Keep going. It's sad, but it's true, and it's kind of inspiring too. So as we start to wrap up our conversation with Bryce today, Bryce, I want to take a moment and thank you very much for being here. It's very special. You're on Street Strong. You're actually our very first guest. I want you to know that. This is mainly a solo podcast, and we do get some requests, but you were just exactly what we needed. We needed somebody who's been through it, who can speak to it. You did exactly what we were hoping you could do, and I really can't thank you enough.
Yeah.
You and I both know the kind of folks who listen to this, and they're going to be very grateful you took time, quality time, to just be real and talk about this. So, like, can't thank you enough. Before we let you go, do you have any final thoughts or advice for our listeners out there who might be listening?
Just if, final thoughts. Yeah, you know, if you have, the faster you admit you have a disease or a mental illness, the faster we can get around to getting better, right? And there, you know, I know resources could seem hard to find, but they're out there. If you're listening to the podcast, I'm sure that Tommy has a ton of resources available.
Yeah.
I wish I had a magic thing to say. I always think it's just say the right thing, right? But it's like, it's not. It's just a consistent message of like, from people like you or like me, that you got to try. It's not okay to do nothing. And I hope
That's the best way to close out. It's you just have to try. You just have to press on. And there is no silver bullet, and there wasn't supposed to be.
No.
But I mean, for anyone who still has any questions, just replay the episode, because I think you spelled out a very realistic path and a very hopeful one too. So thank you again, Bryce, so much.
Yeah.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. To our listeners, if you want to learn more about Bryce's work on Mile High Recovery Center, we'll make sure to link his resources in the show notes of this episode. Remember, no matter the struggle, recovery is possible, and there's always a path forward. Bryce showed that today. Thank you all for tuning in to Street Strong. Don't forget to rate, like, and subscribe. Every single like, comment, and subscription really helps the podcast grow. Thank you all so much. Good luck to all of you. And have a wonderful rest of your evening. Okay, bye-bye.